My name, Carol Tomer, and this session is on inclusivity. And the title might suggest more specifically inclusive language. If God is male God? And I didn't make up that wonderful question, as most of you probably know. It's the way Mary Daly made the statement, not the question, in her book Beyond God the Father back in 1973. We try to do these kinds of conversations or sessions at Holden every now and then, but I realize that this particular audience probably knows much of what I'm going to say. So what I'd like to do is approach the topic in terms of ministry with people about questions of inclusive language. And I'll just make a number of opening comments and then like to learn from all of you and each other about how we've been dealing with some of these things or not dealing with them. First of all, I want to say that for me, inclusive language is just part of the broader issues of inclusivity. And I sometimes think it's unfortunate that we focus so much on inclusive language, because I think some people, in parishes especially, think that's all of what inclusivity, feminist theology, being progressive or whatever is about. That's sort of what trickles down. And they think, what's all this stuff about language, and never kind of get to see the rest of the iceberg. However, having said that, we will go on and talk mostly about inclusive language. We could talk about how inclusive language has come out of some of the insights of feminist theology, that feminist theology has heightened some of those concerns for us, heightened our awareness of the sexist society that we live in, heightened our awareness of the patriarchal culture out of which the Judeo-Christian tradition has come. And heightened our concern for a bottom line for some people being whatever furthers and a just society. That's the bottom line criteria for some people in terms of theology. But I want to look also at what has happened in our culture that has heightened the concern for inclusive language. And I think we don't often talk much about that. The acknowledged shifts in the use of language, the English language. I don't know the exact date, but I think it was, one source I found, it was at least by 1977 that the Oxford English Dictionary was saying that the generic use of the word man was obsolete. Now that's quite a while ago. And I think we still have people kind of debating the meaning of the word man. And the dictionary, I don't cite a dictionary as a way of saying, well, now let's get in step and follow. Dictionaries only change when usage does. That's a reflection of the language use and the culture as I understand it. That's when that stuff finally gets into the dictionary, not because the dictionary decided that we should all start changing our use of that language. Also, in an article by Gail Ramshaw Schmidt in 1982 in Worship, she reviews some things about general writing guidelines that I found pretty helpful. I'll just read you this section. Language guidelines of publishing houses, especially those houses which produce children's books and texts, indicate the state of the language with regard to gender. Of course, such thoroughgoing alterations of the gender system are not already commonplace in America. But we see a movement legislated in some significant places further to remove gender considerations in American English. The guidelines of publishers like Macmillan and McGraw-Hill make the following policies, and here she's citing their guidelines as published in 74 and 75. Man and its compounds are no longer acceptable as generic terms. Words like ship and country are it, not she. Occupations are not to be typecast by sex. Occupational titles must not be sex specific, except for sperm donor and wet nurse. Human emotions and manners of behavior are not to be stereotyped by sex. Female gender word forms, poetess, are to be abandoned. These guidelines say of the generic he that it is no longer acceptable. The sentence can be reworded or cast into the plural. He can be replaced by one, or he or she, as in one or the other. He might alternate with she. An indication of the force of these moves is the 1977 statement by the National Council of Teachers of English, saying that except in the most strictly formal usage, their is preferable to his as a singular possessive pronoun. That now their is considered an acceptable singular possessive pronoun.
I used that with one of my teachers at Hope. They just,
well, most people don't say anything.
Did you know Deloitte Hochstetter?
I know the name.
Kier's discoverer.
Oh, yeah, I just read that recently.
Huh. This is my conclusive language.
Well, you know, I think really if the dictionary is accurate in any way, whether we like it or not, really isn't the issue anymore. We're going to be misunderstood if we say man and want to keep meaning male. If it is true that the culture now understands it as a generic term. I mean, I think we can appeal to people maybe on that basis. I don't know. All of this is to say that the culture is changing as well as some of our theological understandings. And I think that's an important starting point with people. And from there, after we talk about our language for people, then I would guess that that's maybe the process for you in your places of ministry, that then after we talk about that or we kind of shape that up some, then we start talking about our language for God. And when we talk about our language for God, we probably get more disagreement, more variety of perspectives. And I think the starting point on that issue has to be that God is beyond all our language, that we've got to start with that sense of humility and inadequacy for our language. And here, just one other quote that I want to read you, also from this article by Gail Ramshaw Schmidt. And by the way, have all of you heard of Gail Ramshaw Schmidt? She, along with Gordon Lathrop, are the people that have put together this lectionary for the Christian people, which is being used more and more in congregations. It's now, you know, just came out in cycle C, too, so now we've got A, B, and C.
Who's that published by?
Pueblo.
Also, Oxford Fortress now publishes an insert using that translation.
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah,
it was just like,
yeah.
Great, wonderful. Do you know how long that's been out?
Yeah, Advent.
They just started doing it.
And she was one of our speakers a couple years ago at our pastor's conference. Most of the Lutheran pastors were on.
This probably did not commend herself.
This isn't a variation of the one that was done by the National Council of Churches.
No, they did it independently, separately.
No, it was terribly awkward.
That's better. The only place I argue with why they translate Son of Man by
Man of Heaven.
Yeah, that's no advance.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Plus it loses the sense about what, I mean, I don't know that you can do anything with Son of Man. I've read a lot of stuff on it, because you're stuck with a technical term, but the Man of Heaven just loses it. Unless you had Daniel 7 in front of you.
But it generally, I think, is just much more poetic, generally very nice.
Well, it's a very conservative redoing of the RSV, so that it has the cadences and sound of RSV, so people don't even hardly know they've had it.
So this is a kind of a subtle way to help affect the transition, in a sense, is that what you're saying?
Is, they use the Sovereign,
No, not a whole lot.
They use, they stay with Lord, and, I mean, they...
But where the NCC just plopped words in, they reworked it in a way that it maintains a good sense of flow.
It's much easier to use, because I tried to use the other one, and it was, just had to redo it again.
It probably follows, this follows...
That's right, it called attention to itself, and this one doesn't.
No, it...
It's Roman Catholic Episcopal Lutheran, so it may not hit your...
There's lots of words.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so...
It's in the bookstore.
Yeah. Gail Ramshaw Schmidt, who now happens to be married to Gordon Lathrop, with whom she worked on this.
How many last names does she have now?
Is she married before, or dropped to Schmidt, or...
Yeah, she's Gail Ramshaw now, but, in fact, let's see what this edition says. Yeah, it says Gail Ramshaw, no. Anyway, this article in 82, she was Gail Ramshaw Schmidt. And the other thing I wanted to read you is... She says, only when analogy, as Pannenberg says, opens up to mystery, only when our language of God leads to awed doxology, are we recognizing the limits of human language in its speech of God. When in a homily, an anecdote about a father-child relationship or about the birth process affirms a basic similarity with God, the simile has shrunk our God. Always in analogy, what is unlike is more than what is like. Theological sensitivity in explicating analogical language frees us from distortions and helps point to the glory of God. If we would grant often in our speech that he is wholly inadequate as a personal pronoun in referring to God, much of our difficulty would be lessened. Instead, we hear a vociferous defense of this masculine designation, as if it were in some way true. I think also, increasingly in ministry, one of the things that has heightened our awareness of the inadequacy of some of our God language is people speaking out of their experiences of abuse. And I think it's very hard for us, given the increased awareness of people who come out of those situations, to deny the importance of language for them and the way those images function for them. And so I think at the heart of our discussion of language for God is an issue of evangelism. And I think when we speak of it that way, I think it's harder for people to turn a deaf ear to what's that. At the heart of this issue is people hearing the gospel and how we do that with integrity, how we proclaim that. I think also it's true that in seminaries increasingly concern for language about God is the norm. And I sense sometimes that people in parishes think that this is some kind of aberration that we're trying to perpetrate on them, and that the rest of the world is doing that old stuff.
In the last issue of Dialogue, there was a little editorial where the guy said, "Inclusive language is God." It was just that.
Guess what?
Did you read that?
Oh, I don't think that. Is that Jim Destigan?
No, in Dialogue, that inclusive language was just a fad and it's now over.
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah, I don't
remember. I'm trying to think of his name.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it. I haven't seen it.
One of the things that we need to be aware of, however, is change represents violence to the status quo, and that the status quo is the place, or the, is a treasure to many people. You know, that we're doing violence to people's treasures, their memories, their traditions, and so forth. And so there's been some insensitivity to that in the zeal to get on with it, you know, get on with the evolution of the language, to the improvement of the language, or purification of the language, if you will. There's been some insensitivity to the violence we are doing to tradition and to closely held, you know, treasures that people have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that does raise for me the question of what's our ideal regarding language. Mm-hmm. And I think some people think it's to stamp out all male images of God, and maybe to degender all references to God. Some people would choose that, but I personally don't think that's the way to go. I think because all our language for God is ultimately inadequate, the best we can do is to multiply our use of images for God, and in that way to convey some sense of the richness of God still being totally inadequate in our language. But and so we don't have to take from people all those treasures.
Take, when you step back from the loaded message and authority of the scriptures and just take the classic poetry of the hymns, and do we go through and rework the work of a poet to make it inclusive? Or do we throw it out because it can't be sung anymore?
Yeah. That's a tough issue. I got ordained this last summer in Northfield, Minnesota, and I thought that it would be wonderful to have all-inclusive language in my ordination service. I got to totally control it, you know, so I'd do this. It was the most exhausting thing I've been through, partly because I learned a lot about those varying perspectives. I happened to be working with the organist, was the St. Olaf College organist. I was working with another woman, Madeline Farrell Marshall, who has done a lot with critiquing hymn texts. And the two of them had very different perspectives about the revisions I wanted to do of some hymn texts. On the one hand, Madeline says, hymn texts are living texts. We should be able to change them. And John, when I changed one verse of Come Down, O Love Divine, had fits, and I said, well, I don't like some of the theology here. Said, oh, but this is Italian excess, and oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. But people won't have the benefit of you having told them that this is Italian excess, for them to understand why these kind of theological statements were being made in some of those texts. But it's not simple stuff. And we at Holden have dealt with the question of our hymn texts, and we have a few resources, more than the average parish, for options for hymns. Not only the Lutheran Book of Worship, but Everflowing Streams, which maybe many of you are acquainted with. We have a little pamphlet of Tozzi canons, and then Marty Haugen, Gather to Remember. I don't think that's totally inclusive. But anyway, we've got several options. But nevertheless, the occasion comes up when someone wants to use or sing a hymn that they love, but we don't have an inclusive version of it, so there we're stuck between those, that love of that hymn and our commitment to inclusivity. And so we either kind of, we use the hymn and feel kind of guilty as, you know, we kind of sing those words, or we don't use the hymn and feel angry that we can't.
Exactly.
And it's not an easy spot there. So we formed, I suggest mm-hmm. we have an inclusivity group. And actually, a number of people were interested. We've been meeting weekly for quite a while. We were working on revising hymn texts, those that weren't copyrighted, and then sharing them with the community. But of course, then you have another conflicting commitment, and that is at Holden, our desire to not use a lot of paper. And we're a much smaller community than most parishes. And how do we balance all those seemingly conflicting.
Put it on a big piece of butcher paper and you hang it from one door.
Put it on overhead.
On overhead.
So yeah, they're tough questions. I would add to what we've been saying, just I think inclusive language is also an occasion for us to talk about bibliolatry and our understanding of the Word of God as being the living Word of God, that Christ is the living Word of God, and not those words that people become so attached to as they appear in Scripture. I think it just becomes an occasion to talk about that, and that our words are always subordinate to the truth they reveal. I think also, increasingly, we need to talk about what masculine images of God do to men. We talk a lot about what they do to women, but do men feel more trapped in identities of power, control, because as we continue to talk about God as male? Maybe you all can say more about that. And also the issue of inclusivity, and this has come back to where I started, is not simply gender issues. We could be talking about cultural pluralism, and when God is white God. What's our language doing in terms of color, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of even how we use light and dark? I don't know that we hear people saying white and black is a problem maybe in our religious language. We don't hear as much perhaps about light and dark, and maybe because it's much harder to tackle. But I think for us to reclaim the other side of light and the other side of dark and the positive and negative connotations that go with both of those. And I think also our illustrations in preaching to make those more inclusive in the kinds of people that we talk about in those stories and the kinds of roles that they're found in. But that's maybe, you know, there's nothing new about that to mention that to you. I just was going to mention some resources. You experienced the Marty Haugen Vespers service Monday night here. We also have Matins 85. These are both titled this way because they're written by people at Holden. This was written by Tosh Jordan, who was here for a year, and he's not a professional musician, but did an incredible job with this. It's wonderful in terms of language and music. Unfortunately, it's very hard musically. And I think it really only works with a community that sings it repeatedly. Really, Holden should not use it very much when we have guests around. They get one shot at it and it's very hard. But it's very beautiful. And both of these are available in the bookstore. That's not meant to be a plug for you to buy them. But I can't imagine too many communities that could use this successfully. However, there is a new Matin service that, there's a new book, and I wish I could remember the name of it, that's being published by GIA this spring. It was kind of a coup with Augsburg Fortress that, I don't know if Augsburg dragged its heels or what, but it's not exactly a supplement to the LBW, but it's some stuff that Augsburg really wanted to publish. For example, in there will be a Matin service composed by Kevin Boat. He just graduated from St. Olaf College as an organ major, a talented musician, and St. Olaf used it at least for the last year for Matins during chapel, and it's beautiful. It's very singable, and I think that's going to be, I'm anxiously waiting for us to be able to use it here, be the solution to some of the problems with this one. Similarly, Marty Haugen has been commissioned by Pacific Lutheran University's college pastors, campus ministry, to write a Eucharist service. And I don't know when that's due to be done. We're using the first draft here because he happened to put pen to paper on it while he was here this summer and gave us permission to use the first draft. I really like it. I think it's going to be wonderful, and also will solve some of the problems of there just have not been that many options. I think a lot of parishes now are at the point of considering some alternative services and kind of get stuck. One of the ones that Lutherans have been using is Ray McKeever has done three different services, communion services, inclusive language, alternative musical settings. However, generally I think they're assumed to not wear very well. They're a little trite musically. I kind of introduced them at University Lutheran Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they sort of had fits because the congregation has several outstanding theologians there, and they had fits over some of the language, some of the slightly changed theological nuances in the text. But there just aren't many good options out there.
Martin's communion service, I understand, is going to be published with 30 of his hymns by his, whoever's his publisher.
GIA is his.
GIA is going to do that.
Yeah.
Great. GIA.
Of his hymns?
Uh-huh. It's a Catholic publishing company.
Yeah, if you go to a Catholic parish and look through their paperback missals, Marty's all over the place in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's been doing stuff for quite a while, and because they've been into liturgical reform for quite a while, and most of his stuff's very, very good. And he's Lutheran, but he went to Luther College, graduated from there, and I don't know if he'd call himself Lutheran now. They belong to a congregational church, so, but he's been working for... How old?
What, late 30s?
Yeah.
I wanted to recommend this one. This is in the bookstore here. I've been looking for this for ages, and I found this. This is from the Vancouver, Canada, when the World Council of Churches had their big gathering, and it's full of, I mean, talk about inclusive culturally as well as gender, and it's got one I know a particular very nice communion service in it. So it's out of print, but it's here. I really recommend it. It's beautiful.
We don't have many copies left.
Right.
What's the name of it occasionally?
This is Jesus Christ, the Life of the World.
If it's out of print, then can you make copies of it? So that a congregation
don't answer me.
Refuse to answer.
No, really.
That's a good question, though.
Yeah,
another
good question.
Another resource that we use that I noticed that was over on the piano is Psalms Anew. It's printed by St. Mary's Press in Winona. And I wrote to them when I was at Hope and asked them for permission to use that in worship if we would reproduce them, they wrote back and said, we need a list of all of them, so I had to go through the whole LBW to write down every psalm in it, and they gave us permission to use them with no cost.
To make copies?
Yeah, what we did, we printed our own inserts there, because that was before the lectionary, before we could get inserts. And what we did when we called Augsburg, whoever, we told them we wanted, we just thought it'd be a way to lobby them to do that if congregations would ask for that. But Psalms Anew is a very nice translation, but in some places it's too nice because they soften some of the anger that's in the Psalms.
Published by St. Mary's Press, Winona. What I actually like a little better than that is this one. The Psalms, a new translation for prayer and worship by Gary Chamberlain, published by Upper Room in Nashville. And like the psalm we did last night. No, that was from here, sorry. And actually it was Kevin Vogt, the student at St. Olaf, who told me about this one. And I just think it's very nice.
Pointed for... Same.
No, it's not pointed.
That's the trouble with Psalms.
Yeah. We were considering buying copies of this for our use in worship here at Holden, and I thought, not pointed. So we're still stuck. So what we've been doing is doing this, the antiphons, so that, because most of the Psalms in the LBW just aren't. Other resources that I would mention are, this is a new one that we got in a bookstore not too long ago. More Than Words, Prayer and Ritual for Inclusive Communities. And they do look at inclusivity in a broader way than simply gender. Published my Meyerstone books. And this one I think is helpful reading. Wholeness and Worship, Creative Models for Sunday Family and Special Services. And they did an earlier book, was it? Women and Worship, I think.
You struggled with your, putting together your ordination service, and now that you're here, you're struggling with the consumer quantities that, every week, twice a week, or sometimes twice a day, having worship, and you need to feed in new material. You really exhaust the present stuff very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing your own rewriting, and you're also falling back on stuff that isn't rewritten.
Mm-hmm. It's a commitment that you got to be really committed to. It's a lot of work, and I think it means continually consulting the community. Are we committed to this? Because one of the implications for us here, as we've been doing this, is that people have grumbled that we hand out too many things at worship. They've got an LBW, they've got this little pamphlet that the PLU services in, that Marty Haugen did. Oh, there's maybe a little half sheet that maybe we'll bring a different confession or a revised hymn, or we have this little thing we do, bless this name when people are leaving. Sometimes it has been ridiculous, all the things we've handed out to people. But is that an inconvenience that we can allow if we can? And there's mixed perspective on that. So what do you do?
The churches that are growing, when they had their meeting over in Portland at Concordia, they were saying that the way they did it was to use a lot of paper.
Yeah.
And just print up everything in bulletins, and you didn't have to, and that was the easiest way, because otherwise people would get so confused that they wouldn't come back.
Yeah.
The thing that gets me is having to write for permission to use like music and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's what we should be doing. And whenever we even take something out of here, we really should at least be saying, this is where it's coming from.
We have enough copies of that we can use it in the winter community. But you can't, you don't have that luxury.
Right, absolutely. We don't have the luxury to buy a new handbook.
That thing came up last night here. I don't know how many of you were here for the community meeting, but one of the people raised the question of heresy in relationship to some of our presentations, which may not follow the Christian tradition or even use Christian concepts. And we got into quite a long discussion of this, and it occurred to me that one of the protections a community like this one particularly has, and I think this is true of a congregation too, is that contained in the liturgies and contained in the readings and contained in the biblical resources that we use and so on are many built-in protections, so that even though you may have an occasional presentation that is so-called heretical or not following the Christian tradition, you still have many, many built-in protections. But one of the problems I see at Holden here is that in our attempt to use inclusive language, we tend to more and more exclude the use of some of these basic resources, like the LBW, for example, and like the creeds, for example, and the RSV as a Bible study base, and so on. So that I think we're in an interim period right now, where we're attempting to make changes, and at the same time we're not using as much of the original resources that we do have. And I find this to be a really great dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I long for the time when we can rapidly change. I don't think LBW is going to be changed very quickly. And the RSV is still a pretty standard version that we use in Bible
studies. It's going to be revised early in the 90s.
Pardon?
It will be published in a revised version.
Which will be published?
The RSV,
yeah.
In the early 90s.
Yeah, really? Yeah, I understand that. But I say we're in a period right now where I think we begin to lose some of the basic enunciations of the gospel in our attempt to move on. And I don't have any answer to that dilemma. I'm only saying it because it makes me feel a little anxious.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to make a distinction. I don't mind using the RSV in a Bible study, non-inclusive language in a Bible study, because you could say, hey, remember when the...
Right.
But to use it in worship is something else. I think that's why I like the... the lectionary is...
I think
that's saying that. I kind of buy into that. So it doesn't bother me that much. The old stuff in that, it depends on the setting.
Mm-hmm.
That's important, I think.
Yeah, but you see, here we have such a variety of persons who present things mm-hmm. here at Holden. We try to have the whole community participate. So you've got in a congregation, you have the pastor largely leading who is trained theologically. Here we have a lot of people who have no training in that. And somehow we need to have basic resources that we use continuously to sort of keep us on track.
Mm-hmm.
And when we neglect those basic resources, then I think we lose something.
We do generally use the RSV for Bible study here. I mean, just,
But what do you do with the Nicene Creed?
We don't say it.
We do when we use the LBW service, the McKeever service.
We haven't used the LBW service.
Yeah, we are this Sunday, by the way. But
that's 3 months now. You see, so we don't use those creeds.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about.
I can understand that too, because I want to use it, but it's so bad.
Yeah.
The McKeever service has some alternate creeds in it for choices, and the PLU service is only music, so we don't use the creed there. So. Yeah, that's a problem. And a lot of people object to you sticking another creed in their hands, and they say, this isn't what I want to confess.
Yeah.
What is it they don't want to confess in Nicene?
Well, there are so many he's in the Nicene.
It's
father.
Well, but
it
was made man, is that a problem? I think back when I was in school, during Lent, we had a figure, it was a shadowy figure, but it was a figure of a male, obviously, on the cross, and started a controversy. Someone wrote in objecting to that, that it should be a genderless looking figure. And I remember John Stendhal, who was a classmate, the son of Christer Stendhal, who at that time was the dean of Harvard Divinity School, said that was heresy, because if we talk about the incarnation, he was something. He was, you have to be male or female. So is that a problem?
When we do hymn text, what we've been trying to figure out, and the guideline I use is, you're looking at text, trying to figure out now, can we speak of Jesus as he here? Is it speaking of the Jesus of history or the Christ of faith? And if it's the Christ of faith, then I don't think it should be a gender reference. Do you agree with that?
One of the compromises. And they're not having compromises. They are just that. They get you through the...
What do you think about the Christa crucifix?
See, the thing for me with that is I don't mind keeping the male with Christ and with Jesus. But... sort of like we're talking about with God the Father, is to lift up other images. And Christ tells us, that I am, when you help the poor or feed the sick or whatever, there I am, and there am I, or whatever. And that's another thing for me, is just lifting up other images
mm-hmm.
of Christ that may be female or something different. But I kind of stick with them.
Toward that end, I think this is a real helpful book with lay people or anybody else. This Divine Feminine by Virginia Raimi, Raimi Mollenkopf. She basically goes through lifting up throughout Scripture different female images for God. God as nursing mother, God as midwife, God as mother bear, God as female homemaker, and on and on. And it's written, I think, in a way that's very helpful with lay people. I just would mention one more resource that isn't, I think, probably generally known in the church, but is known in Lutheran campus ministry circles, and probably Episcopal ones as well. Excellent Words, Inclusive Language in Liturgy and Scripture. They're at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, campus ministry there is Joint Episcopal Lutheran. And that group of people put this together. And most of the articles are written by the students in that group, and then also with the Lutheran campus pastor. Some of the students had some theological training, but it's got several articles on different issues, and then some, well, they did an exclusively feminine service, just to kind of get the feel for that, and an inclusive language Episcopal service, and an inclusive language Lutheran service. And also went through the Lutheran Book of Worship and the Episcopal hymnal and cited which hymns have inclusive language using their criteria, which they outline. Pardon? Short.
How many pages is it?
Well, quite a few.
But see, then you're using their criteria again.
So, you know, you can, if you agree with their criteria, then it's handy, or it's used as a starting point. You know, maybe their criteria are a little too narrow, but you can use this as a starting point.
Back to when you're speaking of Jesus of history and Jesus of faith, give me a little more background.
The Jesus of history as opposed to the...
how do you Christ. Really differentiate between?
Someone want to... got lots of experts here.
I mean, I can always understand when they're talking about God being not gendered. But... make two distinctions with Jesus.
The Jesus of history as opposed to the Christ of faith. Jesus of history, I mean, I think Stendhal's right in the sense of to make the incarnation less human, to take away that gender aspect of Jesus, I think would be...
That's terrible.
But...
perhaps the distinction comes not so much in the Gospels, but in the letters. Excuse me.
2 years ago, we did a Lenten service and called it Contemporary Crucifixion. And in a way, it was, you know, heresy, but I suppose. But I did paintings for each of them and just took crucifixes, and they were all painted on newspaper. I did all newspaper and just ripped out articles and magazine stuff on issues like, and there was a abandoned child kind, and I did, and I painted on top of those kinds of stories, I painted a crucifix looking little child. I did a, one of them was a businessman, you know, with a, on the cross with no face. I was the only one with no face, holding a briefcase with a milk. And a woman, and an old person. And I said, and the how I got into that was when I was in Berkeley, the crucifix Krista was there. I went over with my class to do that, and it was very fascinating because I took it out of its container with a woman who had seen it before. And when we looked at it, it was just very quiet. And what happened to me, anyway, was that it humanized. It made that we're so used to it, your cross, crucifixion, that when I saw it done in a new way with this woman, it brought it, it was very much more real. It was a much a more human kind of thing. And I introduced that stuff and say it's important to remember that Jesus was a first century Jew. But once we acknowledge that, we can also portray, I think, Jesus in all these kinds of forms. That's what Matthew 25 and all that other stuff is about. Mm-hmm.
To continue.
And so it's not a simple, you know, it's heresy. I think it's much more complex thing.
To continue to respond to your question, I would also add that the Christ of faith, as opposed to the Jesus of history, is beyond the confines of historical actuality, a particular time in history. So when we speak of the Christ of faith, we speak about God's saving activity, God who continues to be Redeemer, and that aspect of God, Christ, more than Jesus as a particular person who lived in history.
Is that it, all?
Well, I understand what you're saying, but... Mm-hmm.
So, like, in my understanding, one real seems simple to me is the, maybe it simplifies it too much, but Christ takes form in a band of persons now. Christ takes form in a band of persons. In a group of persons now, we become Christ's hands and feet, care for each other in the world. And so, in that way, we're talking about the Christ of faith. So what it does, it goes beyond the historical being of Jesus into more of a spiritual realm. We become the physical body of Christ. And so it's men and women, children and old and young. And, you know.
Is there faith in the band then? In ourselves? Is it community then?
That's...
But to emphasize, part of it, yeah. To emphasize Jesus' maleness too much is that almost to say that Jesus had to be male, and it just happened to be male. Maybe he had to be male in the first
culture,
century in order to get the word of Christ, but that's...
Why not be satisfied with that? I just think this
Because to insist upon it is to make it too important.
Well, I think it is important. My wife, once upon a time, worked in a hospital where they did sex change operations. It was the end of a long study. And they were all male to female. And without getting to all that stuff, she said it was really difficult to relate to those people. She learned how important one's sexual identity was, in just speaking. Were they men? Were they women? It's just part of our humanity that we're either men or women. And to kind of dilute that becomes a problem for true humanity.
But when you relate to Jesus, are you relating to Jesus in history or Christ as Savior?
Both.
Is it improper to say Jesus the Savior?
Mm.
See, that's where I find it difficult. And maybe I'm the only one that's not a pastor in this group, but I have gone to an awful lot of pastoral things like this, and much more so than the average person in the congregation. I would think they would find it very difficult to understand. Or how do you think your whole congregation felt about your Lenten service? I would think it would cause a lot of problems.
I've been there for a while, so they
But I also think it's important to recognize that for a lot of people, it's an evangelism thing too, because a lot of folks don't want to belong or go to church because they can't relate to this male Jesus.
Okay,
Christ. And so when you free this, that when you do, it's not either or.
The people that came to hear that were his congregation. It wouldn't be the people that aren't coming.
But just doesn't mean Jesus means diddly squat to them. I know that.
Actually,
no. There's a rotating thing, so these kind of things went from to five different Lutheran churches.
But what I'm saying is this idea might open up the idea of Jesus. By seeing these different images, it might even make the male Jesus more available to them because it expands him. The maleness is important, but it goes beyond that.
Yes.
I mean, for some,
whole
in some ways, if you stick to the maleness of Jesus, too, for one thing, part of my defensiveness with it is that people use that a lot for why women shouldn't be pastors.
Yeah,
it's because then the
true.
Focus is on his maleness, not on who he was as a servant.
That's right. I think there's a fine line there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for me is when I when I saw that Krista statue that was, that just opened, that was an important thing for me. Because it was so powerful, because it was a different form in it. And, you know, I think we have to kind of, in the history of art, there's black Jesus, there's Italian, just look at it. And, And there's a sense that these, you know, modern Nordic quarterback Jesus kind of figures are okay. They're bad art, but at least to identify with those kind of people. Because the whole history of art, the Jesus portrayed in all those kinds of forms. There's that's important.
Yeah, there's an interesting book by a Japanese author, Shizuko Endo.
Yeah.
A Life of Jesus, which I think really, you know, he says, his theory is that why Christianity never caught on in Japan, although it's been there certainly as long as it's been on this continent, is that, that they came with a triumphant, paternalistic Christ, and the Japanese people need a maternalistic, nurturing Jesus. So he tries to do a life of Jesus from that perspective. And it's very interesting. Are you familiar with
yes.
that book? I mean, I think it really gets at some of the issue that we're talking about here. About and the other, another interesting book is Pelikan's Jesus or Christ Through the Centuries, which really got nailed, I think, accurately by women, because there are no, you know, I mean, there are any women in it. But it really shows how every, not every century, but through the centuries, they have mined from the gospel and from human history and all of that many images of Jesus. That, and the question is whether that formed the centuries or the centuries formed that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I think it's another powerful way of getting at what a metaphor, what an image is for us. And they're long-term, both in terms of their formation and of what they form. The worship with the architecture last night was, that's important for us to think about. You know, Winston Churchill said one time, you know, we build our buildings and then they form our lives. We never think about that. So, I don't know what we're
I just want to say I really appreciate your perspective a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thankful you said something, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious what you lose, what happens for you, what do you lose, what if that's taken away from you, or the idea of seeing a woman, Krista sort of thing, what is it that is lost for you in that? Or?
I would say that nothing is lost. It's just that I don't feel the need for it
uh-huh.
either. And I think that would be the dilemma too, here at Holden, where you are committed to inclusivity. And then there might be people who come along that really don't seem to need that necessarily, but therefore are sort of made to feel, but you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if you don't use the LBW, which they might be very comfortable with, and therefore you're not meeting their needs either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the dilemma, I think.
I know we ran into that in seminary. PSR is so committed to Pacific Schools of Indigenous, all the way committed to it, and it's in their bylaws and everything. And for the black community that was there, which was small, but was there, they felt excluded because of the importance of God as Father, and the importance of Jesus Christ and his maleness, and I mean all of that. And so it felt like that they were being pushed out. Not respected for their perspective on that, so you always run into it, and that's why I think it's so important to not get into either or,
mm-hmm.
but to
and also I think a sense of the inadequacy of all language forms. What really burned it on me was in a parish in Russell, Kansas, they asked me to go out and teach a religion course at a girls' initial prism, they called it. In other words, it was girls that got into trouble and they were institutionalized and yet they weren't put into a prison. So they called it, it was Kansas State Young Girls Reformatory or something like that. And I went out there and they said, we want you to teach kind of the basics of Christianity. So, you know, I go out there and I start talking about God the Father. And here's this girl, just, I can tell this gal was having real trouble. So I drew it out of her and Father raped her. And she hated God immediately. Well, then, you know, my young naivety, I said, well, then maybe what we need to say in order to get the image, the caring image, is we need to say God our mother. And then in the same class was a girl who had been sexually abused by her mother, and she hated that image. So here I am trying to teach something about the nurturing, caring character of God using the image of father and mother, but depending on the on the person, you know, there were, you know, this background of their personal histories came out, and I said, well, I'm stuck. And
what a great way to get to their personal history.
Yeah, but that's not what I was not called out there to do some, you know,
psychoanalyzing
these kids and their problem. I was out there to sort of teach him the basics of Christianity. So then we struggled. The fun thing about that was that it got the attention of everyone, and we started talking about, you know, what do these images in the right sense mean to imply in relationship to God. But that's where we're dealing with the limitations of all language forms. And the cultural baggage that all of us take into that. In fact, my father was a more honest, a more open, a more caring person in many ways than my mother. My mother was very rigid. So I carry into the image of God our Father that image of a father who was a much more fair, a much more graceful, a much more forgiving sort of a person, and, you know, the image. So I think, you know, we've got to struggle with that whole thing as pastors out to every time we prepare a sermon, and recognize that people out there are hearing a lot of different things than we are hoping to communicate.
I think that's important in a different regard. St. Augustine on the Trinity has a line about how our human language suffers under the poverty of speech. It cannot communicate, and yet we must not leave things unexpressed. We must express them. And so we use this human language, even though it is impoverished, to get at point to that which we are trying to express. And I think we have to say that a lot.
Thus the music and thus the art, the various kinds of visual arts, you know, that we need to also approach God. The words don't do it.
You know, to shift the discussion a little bit to the second half of the title, you know, it seems to me the imagery of the language runs both directions, both positively and negatively. If God is male and then is male God, that becomes both an alluring call, if one is male and God is male, to be like God in a positive way. And so if we don't have some feminine images of God which provide also that the pattern for caring is God, male and female. I mean, I don't think we often think about that we impoverish the language of our ideal, or the ideal image, which ought to be something that lures us to be more than we have been. So I think it's important that we lift up, you know, since there's been so much male language, that we do hunt down the divine feminine to lift that to be for us a help
you know, and knowing that there's a burden with that. I mean, it's, and we've got a lot of trips laid on. I remember when Melvin Knudsen was the bishop or president of Southeastern Minnesota District, and I write you fathers, and I liked the stuff very much then, but when you thought about it all the way through, it was a big burden he laid down to be God to these kids, you know. And that's a wonderful ideal, but it's burdensome. So it's a sharp sword. It's two-edged.
Why is that a wonderful ideal?
Well, I think we're called to be as caring as God. I don't see.
Yeah. Father-children thing you threw in there, I have a hard time with that as an ideal.
Well, I think the Bible's full of the language of God and God's children. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm trying to be cautionary in how far you push that, but I think we need always images beyond us, and there are other, you know, there would be other kind of literature that would be helpful to that, raise the issue reluctantly in one sense because we haven't done our homework with feminine images of God that would call us to that too, even as males, mm-hmm. to be compassionate and use that word.
I've read an article this last summer in Christmas Century, and I can't remember who it's by, but it was about the world as God's body, and talked about some of the trouble with having so much emphasis on God as a parent. Then we run into this whole idea that God's going to take care of everything, and that where is our responsibility in it too, and the importance of using some other images that call forth our responsibility as stewards. And that's where I get a little hard time with the parent-child image all the time. We don't do enough with
the shepherd-sheep thing.
The shepherd-sheep. And what that does with pastors and churches. You know, so the pastor has the knowledge and the word and is the vessel to God, as opposed to that we're all vessels.
Almost always in the Old Testament, the shepherd is the king. It's not a clergy symbol at all in the Old Testament.
Other concerns, reactions? Are any of you kind of not so sold on some of this stuff? Are you working on these issues in your congregations, or is something whose time has not yet come for?
I guess I've struggled with how to keep the old folks in church while you're getting new ones in. And I think this has very much to do with that very thing. Because the church doesn't want, you know, they say, Pastor, don't throw all these new things at us that we have to change. I just want to die in peace. And, so how do we keep the parish going when we throw new things at them that will probably draw new people in, but will they stay alive in the meantime?
I think it's very easy to go to that lectionary. I don't think that's a problem at all, but I think what will happen is if they would go to a church that used the old language, they'd just be offended after a while. Mm-hmm. I'm sure my people would just go,
you would use this lectionary, as long as it's not side by side with the old one, mm-hmm. and if they don't know it by heart, they won't know.
That's right.
And
then later it would
in be our preaching, I think that there's just no excuse to use them. All of us have got back to those old sermons. Just been crying out.
I think it's.
We do. We've done classes on inclusive language and things.
And
the choir, we do have some arguments in the choir. Oh, come on, we gotta change this.
And do stuff that catch yourself. I catch myself in preaching using. You know, the old male things, and I catch myself and
at least reflect that I'm struggling with it, mm-hmm. and that there's limitations to it, and I think it affirms, we have a number of younger couples in our parish in the new mission where some of the gals especially, they don't like the old biblical Pauline view of the woman with the veil, you know, shutting up in the church, and at least they know I'm, as an old man, struggling with it, you know.
But I don't think until you really are pressed by people, you probably, it's too hard to make the change, so you just stay with what you've got, mm-hmm. until you're really put to the test. And then,
first congregation was old, and I was leading the charge, and I just got tired of leading the charge. You know, yeah. having the women of the church saying, oh, come on, you know, and pulling me back. And I finally just, you know, made a comfortable compromise for myself and moved on. And, I'm enough of a contrarian also, in that I'll say that inclusivism is also has a demonic potential. And inclusivity is one thing, but conclusivism can become a rival.
Mm-hmm. New legalisms for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For those of you who are Lutheran, I think it was in maybe the last, what is it, they call it Action Packet still, or something like Seeds for the Parish, but has a different name. There was an article in there by Susan Granada about working with inclusive language in her congregation over the course of time and about not forgetting about the ones who were there all along. But I think it laid out real well the process of just slowly working with this. Mm-hmm. It's an issue of ministry. It's working together, asking what does it mean to be Christian in this place, trusting each other, not just dropping in, I just arrived as a pastor, plop, and we're going to do this.
Your impression that new edition of the dictionary that said this is archaic, you know, and, you know, this is the history point at which we change, doesn't have the sensitivity that we learn our languages and relearn them over 80 years or our lifetime. And it's a very evolutionary thing. And the dictionary is part of it, but it's you know, sometimes leading and sometimes behind, and it's an ongoing evolutionary thing.
One of the good things I think about Holden has been that this has been a spot where people have been introduced to it. If they have come from congregations who they haven't even given it a thought, here they are, Holden, and what a better place to be introduced to it in a loving way, mm-hmm. and having a chance to talk about it. Because I think it's brand new for some people who come
here. And that's one of the struggles we have about using the LBW, because people hope, expect, perhaps to get exposed to some new things. So if we use the LBW and it's there one Sunday here or something, so yet we don't want to convey the sense that that's defunct, you know, or to relate to how they experience worship in the parish too. You know. So yeah.
I think we struggle with this more in the church than some places. At least the politicians I hear in the news, not that I watch TV, but their language is really outdated. And I at least hear more of the struggle with the language in the church than
that's
other
true.
Arenas.
Yeah, do you think that's true?
I noticed that a lot. Was it Bush or all of them? They're still saying man, or who is
even,
it?
Even the up and, you know, the Tom Brokaw or Dan Rather.
Yeah, that's it.
The news.
Yeah.
I can't believe that they're doing that.
NPR is a little better about it.
Yeah. But often, I think it was CBS, Dan Rather, I thought, why aren't we all writing letters? You know, like, can't they get with it?
No. Some time ago, I really struggled with, and I think came to the conclusion that I'm not going to resolve all of the issues that are before us. But maybe it's okay just to be one who's in the struggle, you know, in the process. And, and we don't have to have the whole answer, but you know, kind of a people on the way is a good place to be. At least that's my comfort zone. Getting the inclusive language, you know, addition in, that's no big deal. Right, yeah, that'd be a big deal.
I have a question. You used the word feminist theology or feminist, what does that mean? No, and I'm asking very straight. I thought, you know, you said we're not the poetesses anymore, we're not poets. Should we not have, we shouldn't have feminist theologians? We should just have theologians? Or is it, is that describing something that they write about, feminist theologians? You understand what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, I didn't say we shouldn't have poetesses. That was part of the guidelines.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
A definition? That is that what you're?
Well, is it should we be using that word? That's my question. Yeah.
I think,
is it defining something within the study of what they're, the theology, or is it almost being condescending to use that word to describe the theologian? That's my question.
I'm anxious to hear what the rest of you think, but I've sometimes struggled with the word feminist, because I think at one level you can define feminism as the belief that men and women are equal. But because it, in that definition, it's women who haven't been equal, that there is some sort of leaning toward, you know, they're the ones that need to be. So, but feminist, I think, steers off a lot of people, because it kind of, for some people, suggests that only women can be feminists. So I struggle with that word, but I think that feminist theology grows out of some understandings about patriarchy and sexism and women's experience, and brings those understandings to theology and does theology in some new ways, perhaps. But I put it in the framework of, it's one of the liberation theologies.
Yeah. Do you know what was important to me? Like, Hordern has a little book called Faith and Experience.
Uh-huh.
And talks about all theologies based on experience. And then he has this line that just hit me over the head. The problem is that for hundreds of years, we've been doing our theology and interpreting the Bible on the basis of the experience of white, middle-class males. And we could probably add Western. And there I was, and that's bingo. And so I started reading feminist theology at that point as a liberation theology and saying, hey, this is the one, you know, closest to me. After all, my mother, my wife, and my daughter are all
good mother.
Women, and
he didn't hear me yesterday. I think it's really important because of the whole needing to lift that up for now. I had a friend, and when I was working as an administrator at seminary, he came in one day into my office and said, why do we always have to pinpoint, this is feminist theology, this is black theology, and all this sort of stuff? And I said, because we've all been living in a world where theology, I mean, you don't have to say this is white male theology, because that's always what we study.
That's right.
But part of, right now, part of the process is needing, is lifting that up and claiming that this is another perspective. And maybe someday we won't have to do that.
So in fact, it's already happening. You know, it's been happening for a
while. Yeah, it's a transition time, I think.
As soon as you discover liberation theology is liberating white males, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back to way long back, you mentioned how are you given permission to change words of hymns now?
Mm-hmm.
And how can you? Have you found that you can? Can you get permission, or if these people are dead, what do you do? I mean,
I'll show you what I had never known before about,
I'm a stupid on this issue. In the back of the Lutheran Book of Worship, for instance, you can look up the status of each hymn, and it'll tell you. For example, hymn 446, the text is copyrighted, and it'll tell you who it's copyrighted by, in this case, the Lutheran Book of Worship. Other hymns have simply the setting is copyrighted. That's basically the harmonization of the tune. Others, the tune and the text. Others, the tune and the setting. But, so there you have a starting point. So
the text is copyrighted, you can't mess it.
Well, then you have to deal with, you know, who's got the copyright. But the ones that aren't copyrighted,
you're free.
Free of burden.
So that's a kind of a starting point for that.
My starting point is more Augustinian, you know, love God and then sin courageously.
Catch me.
Who was it?
They made a few. Wasn't it the Archdiocese of Chicago?
Yeah.
Was in the fire for $3 million.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't say that courageously. They really sin courageously.
Yeah, but it's not worth it.
No. We burn them all at the end of the service.
But it's a good question. Yeah.
I do have a hard time, like, being a new pastor, trying to figure out how to work with the choir in my church, with trying to lift it up. And for so, because for some of you, they don't care. So I don't want to force them to care. I mean, that's not. But I'd like to do some education, and maybe out of that they might care and they might not, so I'd have to educate with that freedom, knowing that they may claim it and they may not.
And then they start caring.
And then they might start caring. Does, but
does the preaching?
Who does the preaching? I do. I do all the preaching.
Got a good place to do this, the initial teaching.
People are different places. I just thought of two women that are, one is probably about 60, or probably 70, one is probably about 60, both of whom I have served, they've been in parishes I've served. One came back after spending 4 months in Poland last summer and into the fall, and came up to me and said, I learned a new word, inclusive. She's probably 70 years old. The other woman I just talked to a few days ago has been up to Holland for the first time. So it was good to be up there, but the one thing that bothered me was some of the ways they had to be so inclusive with their language.
Yeah.
It's marvelous. We're just such a beautiful variety. What is he saying?
Some of them are jerks.
More jerks?
I have the most difficulty with speaking of God, because I like, it's hard, I don't naturally talk about God as mother, except in a few weeks. And I don't like, during Lent, there's the mother hen, you know.
Oh.
I mean, we got to take advantage of it. But that's not an easy thing for me to do, although I'd like to be able to do that, but it's just,
see, but on the other side of that, to me, having heard of God the Father all this time was very comforting to me. Because I never felt that, because I was a woman, I couldn't be father-like, when you think of the father images. And having known that there was always this mother hen gathering, you know, that gave me a feminine feeling as well. But what's wrong with feeling like that? You want to be as good a father as you can, as a mother.
Oh.
See, that has never bothered me.
Mm-hmm. And when we don't use one or the other, then we lose the relational thing, which is the point.
Right. And I think ultimately, you know, whether it bothers you or not, you know, we don't want to try to make it bother you, but because there are people for whom it is an issue, mm-hmm. that's our invitation to broaden our...
Right.
You know,
and I
yeah. Well, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good discussion. Good to share in the wealth of your experiences.
You're here. Interestingly, just a thought that came to mind with your saying that, when does it become an issue and not an issue? In other words, what makes it an issue? And is it an issue in the cases of misuse and abuse of the very reality of the meaning, father or mother? What's the driving force
for change. Is it the abusiveness of the Godfather concept that...
I guess I'd say the driving force for change is not only people's experiences, but because of their experiences, our understanding of the inadequacy of our ways of speaking about God.
When we take human language and try to describe God,
that it's been limited, and it always will be limited, but it's been too limited.
And I think it's when grassroots people finally say, I'm tired of feeling left out, or I can't find myself in here, and I'm finally going to say something. It seems like that's when change begins to happen.
Well, then it's a sense in which it's not only inadequate, but the inadequacy results in not allowing it to be inclusive.
You know, I think that's maybe been more out there than we think. I have talked to a friend of my wife's who she teaches with, and who would kind of like to go to church. And she did when she was little, but when she was young girl, fourth, fifth grade, something like that, with all this male language, she just, and she couldn't even articulate it then, but she said, hey, this is not for me. I mean, I'm not... And in some way, this is not for me, just because of the language. And,
and
couldn't articulate that for years.
No. And for people who are articulating, there's an amazing number in very average small town American places, amazing number of sort of parallel to the church or post-Christian kinds of communities of women getting together to do the kinds of worship and form the kinds of spiritual communities that will meet their needs more than, and there they are in that small town and not having many options, worship, you know, they can't go to their local whatever other kind of church, they're kind of stuck, and those kind of communities that are forming suggest to me that over and over again that we're just not meeting people's needs.